Hi everyone, it's Adam from Monkey Tennis here. Just saying a huge thank you to all of you that have supported my charity appeal so far. For those that haven't heard about it, this September I'm going to be swimming 15 kilometres between five islands in Cornwall. I'll be swimming the Isles of Scilly, that's Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. I'm doing it because I want to, but also to raise money for CALM, the campaign against living miserably. It's a well-known statistic that 125 people in the UK die by suicide every week, and CALM run a free and confidential helpline for people to speak through their problems and ultimately to help prevent suicides. I'm looking to raise enough money to train two new phone workers to man those lines, and I'll be doing it by swimming the Isles of Scilly in Cornwall. If you're looking to support me, it would be greatly appreciated. You can donate at justgiving.com. Just go there and search for Adam Swim Scilly. That's Adam Swim Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. All donations greatly appreciated. Thank you for helping me to support CALM. And now, on with Monkey Tennis.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi everyone, Nick from Monkey Tennis here. I wonder if you can guess what I'm about to plug now. That's right, it's our live show on November the 22nd at the Prince Charles Cinema in London's Leicester Square. We'll be discussing all things Knowing Me, Knowing You All. We'll also be joined on stage by Simon Greenall, aka Michael the Geordie. You can get your tickets now at postpoppodcasts.com/monkeytennislive. We look forward to seeing you on the night, and who knows, there might be a Boaster biscuit or two in it for you. See you later, bye!
Monkey Tennis?
Smelly Alan Fartridge.
Linton Travel Tavern seemed an obvious choice.
Monkey Tennis?
At the BBC of all places. Be real.
Monkey Tennis?
Where's my assistant? I do not know.
Monkey Tennis?
I wish things had turned out differently, but I'm glad they didn't.
Monkey Tennis?
It will be called Alan's Show. I decided, and would be absolutely ace.
Monkey Tennis?
But needless to say, I had the last laugh.
Hello again, pod fans, and welcome to Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge fan podcast. We are going week by week through iPartridge. We need to talk about Alan. We are now on to chapter 17, Return to Norwich. I'm Adam Brooks, and I'm joined by Tom Dark.
Tits to all that. I'm sure we can sort something out.
Nick Older.
Like the laughter of a glass-throated child.
And Tom Stab.
Heavy maiden.
So, Return to Norwich, chapter 17. We're now drifting into Tom Stab's era of
Hello.
The iPartridge legacy, if you like.
So yeah, chapter 17, Return to Norwich. I was quite happy to cover this section because it covers the I'm Alan Partridge years and fills in a lot of the blanks that just shows kind of how deluded Alan is. Obviously, his meeting with Tony Hayes and stuff like that. So it fills in quite a lot of the blanks, which is good. So yeah, chapter 17. Nick, if you could talk us through the music choices for this section.
Yes. So you've got All Right Now by Free and Equinox Part 4 by Gene Michael Jarre.
Yeah, that'll do.
Did you ask Nick to do that bit just because of that?
Yes.
Excellent. Nah. Well done.
Good
very,
work.
Very good.
Work.
Very good. Yeah, so Alan's back in Norwich now. We're post Knowing Me, Knowing You All. And Carol has officially left Alan. We know all of these things to be true. So Alan, as a running theme throughout this entire book, is constantly in denial. And he says, if the BBC thought I was going to sit around waiting for them to mull over a second series or have yet another meeting or conclude a criminal investigation into a man's death, they had another thing coming. So, yeah, he's kind of just, you know, he basically thinks that kind of the BBC should be going to approach him about a second series. And obviously, that's never going to happen in a million years.
Massively deluded.
Yes, yep. Of course. So he approaches a chap called Nick Peacock, who is the head of Radio Norwich. And he speaks to him at a charity gypsy fight. a larger-than-life character beset with hygiene issues is how Alan describes Nick Peacock. And Nick kind of, you know, gives him an open brief as to, you know, how and what Alan wants to do at Radio Norwich. So Alan's kind of immediately gone in back into working life at Radio Norwich. And Alan proclaims that Nick wants him to do it, the listeners want him to do it, and I want to do it. Nick says the listeners don't necessarily want him to do it, but tits to all that, I'm sure we can sort something out, which is one of our sort of favourite phrases.
He also talks about how his ex-colleagues didn't have any issues with him. And in fact, sometimes he would bump into them in and around Norwich and would, if he saw them in kind of a wine bar, would arrange for a glass of wine and an autographed napkin to be sent over. Is that highly offensive or just a nice gesture?
I mean, I would probably drink the wine and then screw the napkin up in front of him.
Use it to wipe the wine.
And that's probably what everybody else did as well.
Yeah. It's also something of a tangent, but he does talk a little bit about beauty only being skin deep and that Nick Peacock's enormous wealth enabled him to achieve a marriage. Worth noting, just because he then goes on to compare it to the relationship between Catherine Zeta-Jones, incredibly beautiful, and Michael Douglas, looks like a grey crow.
That is a brilliant description, because he does look like a grey crow.
He really does.
Alan sort of laughs off the fact that he's now doing 12 and a half hours a week of local radio, and that people say that that's a step down from 0.5 hours of TV. Now, question to the group, is that a step up or a step down in terms of, you know, Alan as a broadcaster?
It's a huge step down, and that's why he's chosen to use the only metric where his new situation is better, in that he's putting out more content to almost no one rather than a very small amount of content to millions.
It's pretty conclusive.
That's a good point. Very good.
So him saying 12.5 hours of weekly output versus 0.5 hours, it's sort of like me saying, oh, I've cooked a delicious meal for two, but it's not as good as when I cooked a meal for 10 and threw it in the bin.
Very good. And so Alan being Alan, he kind of wants to make sure that everyone likes him and appreciates him now that he's back on the Radio Norwich team. And he goes up to every single person and kind of accosts them and says, right, point blank, do you like me? And he says, they all say yes.
Funny that.
Under duress.
Yeah. One of the things people will say when backed into a corner.
I actually think that Alan's secret, well, not maybe secretly, but he actually quite likes being on the radio. So I think he's actually not too sort of disappointed to be back.
I think he just likes broadcasting full stop. Yeah. But he just wants to climb the ranks. And I think he sees TV as the ultimate goal. But as long as he's broadcasting in some format, I think he is happy.
And at least there's a sense of comfort. This is the first time he's gone back to something that he's already done. So there's familiarity there.
So you think at this point, Nick and Alan have a very good relationship, with Nick giving him a job pretty much straight off the bat after leaving the BBC. But the cracks start to appear. Alan asks for and believes he's been given the breakfast show, but then bumps into, and I'll take a quote here from iPartridge, the incumbent breck jock, a journeyman DJ called Dave Clifton outside Oddbins. So this is the first appearance of Alan's, you kind of say almost arch nemesis, isn't it? It's his Moriarty, Dave Clifton outside Oddbins. Of course, Dave Clifton is outside Oddbins. So he goes to commiserate him, but it actually turns out that Alan's been given the 4:30 to 7 a.m. slot.
So this is the second time that Alan's automatically assumed he's getting a job that's better than what he's actually getting.
Also some nice references, hidden references to Dave's alcoholism. Yeah, obviously there's Oddbins, but he also says Dave frowned as he loaded his cans into the boot of his car. Now, if you've just gone to buy six or maybe even 12 cans, I wouldn't describe it as loading them. He also then says he laughed and drove away, wine bottles clinking in the boot like the laughter of a glass-throated child.
It's brilliant.
Very nice. Obviously, Alan, infuriated by this, goes and confronts Nick Peacock in the corridors of Radio Norwich. Remember what you said, tits to all that. I'm sure we can sort something out. He repeats it three times, putting the emphasis on a different word each time.
Can someone run us through all three of those iterations?
I can. Number one, tits to all that. I'm sure we can sort something out. Tits to all that. I'm sure we can sort something out. Tits to all that. I'm sure we can sort something out. And then finally, there's a fourth one. Tits to all that. I'm sure we can sort something out.
So he repeats it four times, not three times, but you get the idea. Tits to all that. I'm sure we can sort something out.
The idea is that he says four times, tits to all that. I'm sure we can sort something out. But there's emphasis on a different word each time. So the first time it's tits to all that. I'm sure we can sort something out. Tits to all that, I'm sure we can sort something out. Tits to all that, I'm sure we can sort something out. Tits to all that, I'm sure we can sort something out. So basically what I'm saying is, he says tits to all that, I'm sure we can sort something
out. So what you're saying is, tits to all that, I'm sure we can sort something out.
Yeah, but the crucial thing is, I'm saying it differently each time. So the first time, I'm saying, right. Tits to all that, again, I'm sure we can sort I'm done.
Should we? Yeah, we'll leave it.
Okay, yeah.
There's a little, just a bit of fun.
There's a little note here, a little slight gag that I quite enjoy, which when Alan says that he's delighted to find out that Nick wasn't invited to Fernando's wedding, but neither was Alan.
Despite years earlier pushing for sole custody of the children and then, you know, cut down a few years down the line, he's no longer invited to his son's wedding.
Maybe he was pushing for custody and that was the straw that broke the camel's back. So the name of Alan's show on Radio Norwich is Up With The Partridge.
Yeah, the name of Alan's show is unfortunately not Alan's show.
But I, for some reason, that's only referenced once in I'm Alan Partridge, I believe, and I completely miss it. That was the actual name of the show. I just assumed that it was just a kind of off-the-cuff remark.
How did you miss that? That's like the opening line of the series.
Yeah, I know you're saying you're listening to Up With The Partridge, but I was just kind of like, that, for whatever reason, that just didn't clock with me that was the actual name of his show, because it's never ever referenced again. But I guess, you know, why would you reference
they
it?
They don't ram it home in the same way as they do with Mid-Morning Matters, I suppose. Yeah, it's not the actual name of the real programme.
Mm. And he refers, in this instance of Up With The Partridge beginning, he writes, again, the name Alan's show was vetoed by people who think they know my own output better than I do. Do we think, is he ever going to get away with naming anything Alan's show ever?
No.
Answer is no.
I also think there are probably at least 15 people in this situation that know Alan's output better than he does.
There aren't that
more than that.
I don't know how many people there are who currently have chat shows on the BBC or ITV who could actually get away with doing that. If you'd had like Jonathan Ross, the Jonathan show, it's like it doesn't really.
You'd just call
Jonathan
it Ross
show. Yeah, you call it the
Madonna, Cher, and Prince.
I said they're not current chat show hosts on the BBC.
And you had Wogan,
and one is dead.
Yeah, Wogan's one. That? Wogan's probably the biggest.
And I think
isn't it?
Davina McCall had a very short-lived chat show that was just called Davina, but that failed horrendously.
I can kind of see Davina.
Holly
Willoughby.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You're just saying names now.
There was the Charlotte Church show, but that suffered a similar fate to Davina.
But yeah, I think the point being, particularly doing it on a first name basis, it's just not going to work for anyone.
And Alan talks about how, obviously, in his radio show, he recognises the importance of the music choices, which is something that obviously he's very up on, because he mentioned the same thing when he was doing Hospital Radio about how it was important to play the right music.
And he's forcing everyone to listen to a playlist while they read iPartridge as well. Yeah. So reading out new tracks with every chapter.
So Alan heads to HMV, Virgin and secondhand record shops to study contemporary music. So question to the group, can you remember all the genres that he lists? Adam, you've got the book open, no cheating.
I don't know where to start with guessing the genres.
Start at the beginning.
Are there regular ones? Rock and pop?
Can you not remember the ones that he goes through?
Heavy Maiden is one.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Break something.
Breakbeat.
There's four, by the way, so you got two.
One's got jazz in it?
No.
Brit Rock?
Brit Rock is three. The last one.
I saw the last one, so I'm not going to spoil it.
Gang rap.
Brit rock, heavy maiden, gang rap, and breakbeat. So that's obviously Brit pop, heavy metal, gangster rap, and breakbeat.
Yeah, he spelled breakbeat wrong. B-R-A-K-A-E.
And do you remember what his conclusion from that is?
I do. He comes to the startling but unshakable conclusion, no genuinely good music has been created since 1988.
I have a note on this. I predict that Nick agrees with that view.
Well, he's definitely got a point. Although there are... Yeah, I can see where he's coming from. Yeah.
I had a little look to see what albums were released in 1988, and obviously there are loads and loads and loads. But what I did kind of pick out and want to ask as a question to the group is, what do you think the biggest selling album was in 1988 in the UK? Now, it is obviously quite difficult because it could literally be anything, but what I would say is that it is a female pop star.
Kylie Minogue.
Is the correct answer. Yeah. It's Kylie Minogue's debut album. Amazing. Kylie, self-titled Kylie, was the biggest selling album in the UK in 1988. Other albums that were released that year, Metallica's And Justice for All and Iron Maiden's Seventh Son of the Seventh Son. It was quite a rock-heavy year that year.
Heavy Maiden.
Yeah, Heavy Maiden, exactly. Yeah. And in Alan's show, he has the opportunity to revisit music that embodied an era of Thatcher, Hot Hatches, and Men Who Look Like Girls, Bowie, Strange, Le Bon, Ant.
Not of Andek fame.
That's all I've got on this chapter. Has anyone got anything
just
else to add?
Well, he repeats the Hot Hatches thing in Scissored Isle as well. So that's a bit of a phrase of his.
Yeah, Hot Hatch. I just got another highlight here of something that I really enjoyed. Is the way that Alan uses his assistant here. I roped in my assistant, instructing her to scour longwave radio for far-flung stations and then tape entire shows, pausing whenever a record was played and then unpausing on the song outro, so that she could present me at the end of each week with an audio dossier of continental broadcast trends. So you think, okay, that's already ridiculous and it's absolute mistreatment of an employee. Yeah,
and then
it gets worse. Invariably, I didn't have time to listen to them. Of course I didn't. But I did know she enjoyed being involved, even if she could only... Yeah, it gets worse. Even if she could only tune into most longwave stations by standing on a box and holding the radio out of an upstairs window.
Oh, poor old pivoting Lynn. Also, the idea of like getting a sort of dossier, like a zeitgeist tape, it's the sort of thing people do for prime ministers.
Yeah, in that episode
of the thick of it. Yeah. Not for regional broadcasters that can't be bothered to listen to their own music.
Ideas above his station, yet again.
Anyway, that's the end of this chapter.
Yeah,
so what's next?
It is indeed. So we're up to chapter 18, which is titled Linton Travel Tavern. Nicholas J. Older, what are the music choices that Alan insists on listening to in this chapter?
Oh, it's a good one. It's Be With You by Mr. Big.
Banger. Absolute
lovely
banger.
And that's actually a good opportunity to remind everyone listening that we've got a Spotify playlist of all the songs that Alan lists on his, how does he call it? It's a mandatory playlist for as a companion piece for the book. That's on our social channels. We'll post a link on there and you'll be able to find it.
Yeah.
So, Linton Travel Tavern. Alan sort of starts this chapter by detailing that he spent 183 nights in a travel tavern.
I like the fact he says not a lot of people know this. Well,
everyone knows
the thing Alan is most famous for.
The fourth longest period of unbroken residency in a British hotel by a non-OAP. I did a little bit of research about what is the longest stay in a hotel ever recorded. It's by a woman called Joy Bricker, who checked out of the Town Place Suites in Virginia after 10 years.
Wow.
She stayed there. Whoa. She checked in on the 4th of August 2001 and checked out in 2011. She spent 10 years in a hotel.
Follow-up question. Why?
So, after doing a bit of cursory reading of the article, didn't read it in full, I was crunched. She said that basically the rental prices in Virginia were too high, and she actually saved money, or the price was actually lower for staying in a hotel. She had all of her electricity, water, Wi-Fi already paid for, and it was actually working out cheaper to stay in a hotel.
Yeah, but
than
hotel
it was for
Wi-Fi
rental
is
price.
Awful.
It basically said that she said it had everything that she needed.
Do you think after a while they like let her hang pictures on the walls and like repaint and stuff?
Probably not, but
we'll name that room after her.
Yeah.
I would imagine she would have changed rooms and moved
do you know it. Did she check out because she died, or did she just change her mind about rent?
She moved out. Well, I'll post a link out to it on the socials. So the reason that Alan gives that he's been staying in a travel tavern for so long is that Carol and her lover have moved into the marital home.
So he needed to get out.
I'm also
surprised as well, because I'd have thought that he probably paid for it, or at least in part, and would have said to Carol, no, you get out.
Is the reason ever given in I'm Alan Partridge why he's there? It just says that my wife's left me, isn't it? It's not given that they've moved into the home, but I guess you kind of assumed.
I would have thought he would be the kind of person who would be quite stubborn and he wouldn't want to move out, but I expect what's happened is she's moved her narcissistic sports pimp lover in, and they've basically just been doing it while Alan's in a spare room,
also,
and he's just become so disgruntled he can't bear to stay there.
Do remember, the law always takes a side.
There's some nice little details about Alan's stay in the Linton Travel Tavern that we don't get in I'm Alan Partridge, as far as I know. He's staying in room 28. He talks about how he has everything that he needs in the room of the Travel Tavern. He's got the dining room, bed, lounge, the bed, study, desk, meeting room, bed and the desk, and a gym, the gap between the bed and the wall.
I love that bit.
It's so good. And he basically explains that how choice of room is vital for a long stay. One of the biggest benefits, obviously, being free water. So what he would tend to do is to get in the bath, run the bath, put on the shower, and just sit there with the water cascading down, and he calls it his Caribbean soak.
It was like swimming in the sea during a tropical downpour, he said as well.
You know what? Next time I stay in a hotel, I'm 100% going to try that.
Got to give it a go.
And I'm going to post a picture of me in the bath with the water coming down on the Monkey Tennis socials.
I really enjoyed the way he was kind of justifying the hotel stay as well with, It was like all the best bits of living in a deluxe house, but without the constant endless hassle of having to move between rooms. Don't you hate it when you've got to move from one room to another?
It's terrible. Endless hassle. Yeah.
And also, as he says, then there was the food in the place. Goodness me. Why not treat yourself to 3 restaurant meals a day? I know I did.
Now, for those of you who have read the book in depth, I sort of listened to the audiobook and had the physical book as a kind of companion piece to make notes and look up things. He, at this point in the audiobook, he goes into a long aside about not sleeping with Glenn Ponder when he stayed at his house in a previous chapter. Right. He notes this. Yep. So can someone confirm, is this in the book as a note?
This is a footnote.
Yes. This is a footnote.
This is footnote 147. Yeah.
And I would
book.
Say it's a footnote that's almost got half a page to itself.
Yeah.
Is it worth reading out a section of that? Or?
Well, I think just you have to get the opening, because obviously this happened, what, 3 or 4 chapters ago?
Mm,
when he
just
casually goes, I spent the night with Glenn Ponder. And then the footnote, 4 chapters later, it's just occurred to me that in the previous chapter, it's not the previous chapter though, is it?
If it's Glenn Ponder.
No, I don't think it is.
No, it's not.
HarperCollins.
Maybe that's an extra joke. In the previous chapter, when I said I spent the night with Glenn Ponder, I should make clear I meant I went to sleep at his flat. I did not have sexual relations with him. Thought I'd cut it out now and mention it while it's occurred to me. Believe me, there was no physical contact and the light remained as on as my clothes, save for my socks, which I always remove to let my toes breathe because I have an intermittent athlete's foot. So as I say, no funny business at all.
I like the bit where he says he once hugged a man in Snowdonia called Richard.
I love this final line.
In a sleeping bag.
Yeah, yeah.
He says he hasn't got a gay bone in his body and he runs a nightclub in Brighton called Beef. I checked if there was a nightclub in Brighton called Beef. There is no nightclub in Brighton called Beef.
But Nick, you currently live in Brighton. You lived there for a few years. So has there ever been a nightclub in Brighton called Beef?
Not that I've seen or been to, but...
It is possible.
It's possible, yeah.
And now we get to the first mention of Michael, everyone's favourite work, Geordie.
Aye.
He says that from what he can make out, he's employed in an unspecified capacity. I think that kind of goes...
I would agree with that.
Yeah, I would agree with that as well. He's kind of a bit of a dog's body. He kind of just like does everything, doesn't he? He did see him behind reception once and knows that he's not allowed to handle money. It's also the first mention of Susan. He's not sure how old she is, but she was very good looking for her age. any other notes on Michael and Susan here?
No, not particularly.
Well,
for me.
Alan clearly has the hots for Susan.
Indeed, he toys with the idea of starting a relationship with Susan, but the more he thinks about it, the more he doubts that he should. So that's not really true, is it?
No, I think he's got no chance.
And Alan's logic is that as a customer, he's technically paying her wages, which makes him her boss. Again, not really true.
He's also got a disappointingly hazy memory of Ben and Sophie. Yes. One was a guy called Ben. The other was a girl who often had her hair in a bun. My abiding memory of them is that they were having a relationship. Either that or they were brother or sister. I forget which. Feels like the blueprint for the White Stripes.
He knows exactly what they were getting up to.
Yeah, he's in denial, isn't he?
Yeah, and basically he converts Michael from being an employee paid to do his bidding to a friend that does his bidding. Yeah. That's pretty much everything I have on this chapter. Has anybody got any other notes?
The only other bits I were going to mention that was that we get a note about Michael and his love for guns. Alan goes on to say, but at least he loves something. I'm not sure. I mean, if Michael can't handle money, he's certainly not allowed to handle firearms, surely.
No. Oh, this is black market, isn't it? He's not, yeah. You know, there's...
Also, his terraced home, Michael's, is largely unfurnished, so it seems he's not even really allowed to handle furniture.
Yeah. So the only other thing to mention is that Alan was basically inviting local businessmen into his hotel room while they kind of frantically pitched business ideas at him in some kind of like Dragon's Den style setup.
I would have quite liked to have seen this in I'm Alan Partridge, actually. There could have been some quite... Yeah, funny little sketches. Yeah.
This would have been an incredible thing to have a segment of it after the credits each week.
Well, yeah, isn't the irony as well that kind of all the ideas that Alan was pitching to Tony Hayes were obviously pretty crap.
Mm.
This one actually made sense, and there was a kernel of an idea there.
But he's quite possibly being presented crap ideas. He could have created essentially Dragon's Den.
That's what I mean.
That's a very good point.
That's the joke.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
I was going to say, yeah, as an end credit sequence idea, that would be a bit like in Phoenix Nights, where they have all the cabaret acts performing for them. It could have been like that. Yeah.
That's good. That's nice. Good.
And also, he says he's offering up to a ceiling of £999, but he's never quoted in the book as giving anyone more than 300. And even that, I think he takes it back.
Yeah, he does.
Yep.
So next up, Chapter 19, Clash of the Titans. This one is titled Me versus Hayes. Nick, talk us through the musical choices for this chapter, please.
Ooh, this is Wishful Thinking by China Crisis, my dad will be happy with that one.
Alan's a big fan of China Crisis, isn't he?
Yeah, he is.
From I'm Alan Partridge. So I think what we get from the beginning of this chapter is that Alan actually does genuinely miss the BBC. And he goes there on Tuesdays just to look at it from his car, which I quite liked. And also, as we know previously, Alan thinks that a second series is very much on the card, or so he believes anyway, not literally no one else is on board, despite
striking Hayes in the face with a turkey on TV.
Yeah. And he says that Grandstand backup presenter Steve Ryder would still come and sign him in so he could walk the corridors and have a coffee in the cafe. It's kind of similar to Brent coming back to the office, isn't it? It's kind of a similar sort of thing. So finally, you know, Alan sort of badgers Tony Hayes, and eventually Hayes agrees to a meeting, and Alan kind of phrases it as that the call comes from Tony Hayes demanding a meeting. and we kind of get what we didn't really have before. We kind of viewed the meeting as a sort of third person, the famous meeting between Alan and Tony Hayes. This is Alan's perspective on that meeting. And I think we can say it's a very different meeting to the one that we saw in I'm Alan Partridge.
Unreliable narrator.
Yeah.
But that's why I love the book, because you really get Alan's skewed sense of reality, and also that very obviously deliberate thing that he's retelling.
And I think the difference between what we were doing in the earlier chapters is that we didn't necessarily have the visual references for how it actually went.
Yeah.
And now we can see what Alan thinks happened, but we actually know what did happen.
Yeah. And they've solved a unique problem very well, the writers of I, Partridge, because it's a section that everyone has seen play out in real life. How do you add humor without just rehashing the jokes you've already put on TV?
How do you make it new?
You basically put it on the page as if it happened completely differently.
Yeah.
And from thence,
I do kind of wish it had taken place in a TGI Fridays, though.
Yeah, Alan wants it to happen in a TGI Fridays because he wanted something with chips.
Which I think there is not a TGI Fridays anywhere near the BBC TV centre. However, the BBC definitely do offer chips as a food option.
I mean, the bit I feel bad about for Alan is kind of all the things that he then goes and does off the back of essentially getting this meeting. He doesn't wait for the outcome of the meeting and obviously the successful second series. He essentially makes a lot of big decisions off just getting a meeting with Tony Hayes.
Yeah, so he does a couple of things. So he tells reception at the Travel Tavern that he'll be moving out, and he asks his assistant to find him a new house that befits a primetime TV personality. He then calls Dave Clifton and laughs down the phone for ages.
That's so good. I love that.
So the meeting starts. He describes Hayes as shifty and nervous, which I think from the TV show we can see that's definitely not the case. Alan says that he orders food and wine for both of them, a nice German wine, some Italian food, and UK water. Does that basically just mean tap water?
Pretty much.
In the run-up to trying to get this meeting with Tony as well, he displays a creative side in his correspondence, sending him a telly with a note that says, Alan can barely wait to get started on series two, and a honey roast ham with a message, when can we meet, M-E-A-T?
Very creative.
So good.
Shame he couldn't channel any of that creative TV ideas.
Is it like 2 days after the meeting's been confirmed, he's literally buying a five-bedroom house.
Yes, five-bedroom bastard house. So how Alan sees this meeting going is that he kind of gets bored of the small talk very, very quickly and takes charge of the meeting, demanding a yes or no answer about a second series.
Oh, one thing about his five-bedroom house is the reason he's gone for five bedrooms is because Carol lives in a four-bedroom house.
Yeah. Nice touch.
It was out of the question that he'd live somewhere inferior when he was to be one of the faces of BBC television for the next decade. So he's meeting Tony Hares to discuss another six episodes, and in his mind that means he's the face of the BBC for the next 10 years.
Seems quite perceptive that he's chosen Wishful Thinking as the music track for this chapter.
Very good.
We know the reality of what happened, but obviously this book suggests that Alan demands a yes or no, at which point Hares' face goes pale, he averted his eyes and says, "It's a no." I was going to say, the nearby diners, who apparently have been secretly eavesdropping on our summit, gasped and stared. I'm fairly sure one of them let a roast potato fall out of his mouth. What? They all thought.
So he's adding drama to the scenario. Yeah, and as we know, none of this happened.
Yep.
And then obviously he says that he didn't want to work for the BBC anymore anyway.
Yeah. Makes you wonder why he took the meeting and sent Tony Hares a roast ham, really.
Yeah. Yep. Hares apparently... we know it didn't happen, begs Alan for other series ideas, which he reels off. And then Alan lists all the familiar TV show ideas that we know, love and recognise: Swallow, Knowing ME, Knowing You, Inner City Sumo, and Monkey Tennis, of course. He says that Monkey Tennis is snapped up by TV stations in Laos and Taiwan and ran for two successful years, after which the format reached the end of its natural life and the monkeys were quickly and humanely destroyed.
Does that mean they were thrown into the sea and bounced off a rock? Yeah.
Wonder where he got the idea from.
Yeah.
So he must have actually made a little bit of cash from that then, if it's, you know, a TV programme that's been licensed.
I think it might have all been spent on a humane monkey disposal.
There's actually one idea mentioned in the book that's not mentioned in I'm Alan Partridge, which Alan describes as the ace up his sleeve: Motorway Rambles, a travelogue of Alan walking the hard shoulders of British highways. But the idea had been co-devised with Bill Oddie, and he'd made Alan promise that he wouldn't pitch it unless he was there too, which I think is fair.
Yeah.
My question is, though, if Bill Oddie is that adamant about being named as the co-deviser, why has he not come along to the meeting?
Good point. Yeah, well, yeah. I think obviously maybe Alan had...
Well, he doesn't want to share the glory. Tony's demanded Alan give him more ideas.
I would expect Bill Oddie has probably got his own meeting with the BBC where they're much more receptive.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Alan stands to leave, but Hayes says that they haven't had the cheese course yet. It's that infamous cheesy moment.
Yeah.
So the way Alan describes it in the book is that he slams the handle of the cheese knife onto the cheese board, that springs a cube of cheese into the air, which he catches, wraps in a napkin and puts in his pocket. Now, we all know that that's not true, isn't it? Alan says that he won't...
He did it in a slightly less graceful manner.
Yeah, he stuck the knife into a cheese and shoved it into Tony Hares' face.
I don't know what you mean. I mean, for me, the meeting merely confirmed his long-held desire to continue his career well away from the BBC.
Yes, Alan says that he won't let Hares pay, so puts a £100 note down the male waiter's cleavage. And he did have a cleavage. So, one, he's putting a note down a male waiter's cleavage, and two, it's a £100 note. Surely that's he knows that that's ridiculous and doesn't exist. What's going on there?
It's
almost like the writers don't credit the readers of I, Partridge with the intelligence to know that this is fictitious, and so they've had to put a £100 note in to absolutely seal the deal.
Is it a bit like, because obviously we know Alan is essentially lying, embellishing his version of events, is it just a thing he can't help himself from making it more and more ridiculous? Like, he's layering it on and layering it on.
He's one step away from, I put a £100 note in the waiter's cleavage and then flew into space.
Yeah, essentially. Well, in this instance, he very calmly, very slowly, very proudly walked through the lunchtime diners and away into the night. Lunchtime diners into the night.
Yep, and he's applauded.
How slowly did he walk?
Yep. And as we all know from the TV show, and we all saw it, Alan is applauded out of the room. We all know that.
Oh, that's definitely how it happened.
Full-blown Alan fantasy. That is everything I have on that chapter. Any other notes from anyone else?
Let's move it on.
So, moving on to chapter 20, Proof That the Public Loved Me. Nick, what are the music choices Alan suggests? Actually, no, it's not even a suggestion, is it? It's mandatory.
It's mandatory. So we have a track I'm not familiar with, The Race by Yellow.
I don't know it either.
It's on the playlist if you want to hear it.
I think
it's
on our social channels. They got the track on Ferris Bueller's Day Off. The one that goes, "Ooh yeah."
Is that what it is?
Yeah. Well, no, it's not. I don't think it's that song, but that is
right.
Right.
Just a little bit of added colour to this section before we delve right in. This is the point in my research where I was on holiday in France a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, sounds nice.
It was very nice. And at this point, when I started this chapter, a young French boy called Lenny, I managed to find out using my GCSE French, interrupted my research, and I had to try. Well, I didn't have to, but I tried to explain to him in French who Alan Partridge is. Which is actually quite hard if you've only got a very basic GCSE level French. And I ended up just pointing to a picture of him in the book and just saying, his name is Alan Partridge and he is very stupid. That's basically what I got. Then the little boy's granddad, who was called William, he introduced himself, came and took him away and said, sorry for him bothering me. So I just thought that was a nice little story. I taught a French kid who Alan Partridge is and told him that he was very stupid.
Good work. Rumour has reached us now that he insists on only going out in a blazer badge and tie combination kit. So you started something very special there.
So the time is 4 p.m. on the 8th of May, 1997, and Alan is being held captive in the home of deranged superfan Jed Maxwell.
Yeah.
Alan describes the day starting well. An afternoon with Alan Partridge with Sue Cook, who in this section he openly calls fit.
Yeah. Ravishing.
Yeah, she's his ravishing special guest.
Mm.
Oh, Cookie.
Seriously, I think she's fit.
And obviously, Alan references the meeting with the two Irish TV executives. Alan says that he has a lot of time for the Irish. Do you think this is as a result of his potentially... I was going to say his potentially offensive descriptions of the Irish in the TV show, and he feels like maybe he has to clarify his views.
Mm. I think he's got a lot of time for an Ireland that doesn't really exist, or perhaps existed, you know, 100 years ago.
Yeah.
Alan says that the Irish economy was known as the Celtic Tiger, which he says that he loves, and then it hit a wall, much like the sleeping dog on YouTube. He then reels off a list of his favourite YouTube videos, which include Sneezing Panda, Keyboard Cat, Dramatic Chipmunk, Skateboarding Dog, Otters Holding Hands, and Don't Tase Me Bro. Now, so, I know all of those apart from Don't Tase Me Bro. Do you know that one? Okay.
All right.
I mean, I would say those are probably like... The most popular, of course.
The only one that's missing from there is Charlie Bit.
That's
my finger,
what I was
going to
say.
Yeah.
Isn't that like one of the most viewed clips on YouTube?
It's one of the most, but now I think the most viewed is a music video by Ratman Wiz Khalifa from Fast and the Furious.
Yeah.
It's awful.
Alan obviously says, that the meeting with the Irish executives goes well and they hit it off and they agree to attend RWAP, which is an afternoon with Alan Partridge, which he doesn't call it in the TV show, but I wish he had, because that is brilliant. And then obviously the news breaks that Sue Cook has pulled out, and Alan quotes, "Oh, Cookie, you are as unreliable as you are fit, i.e. very."
I just like as well, it's such a small thing, but like the kind of like the subtle jibes at the Linton Travel Tavern, where he says, "Oh, kind of at the end of our pleasantly greasy breakfast," and it's just a, like a little subtle throwaway thing, but he's having a kind of a jab at them. But
I think you missed something which I thought was quite funny earlier when he's talking about putting on this afternoon of Alan Partridge. He says, "I toyed with the idea of doing an arena gig, but quickly ruled it out."
How quickly? I mean, we've also toyed with the idea of doing an arena gig, didn't we? But I think we ruled it out quickly.
Yeah, ruled it out due to similar reasons.
Audience interest.
Yeah. Alan describes the show as a disaster, despite Michael giving him the pep talk and saying that he hadn't shot any guests or punched anyone in the face with a turkeyed hand.
I thought that was a rare moment of clarity from Alan.
True.
I mean, it was a disaster. There's no bones about it, but normally he would gloss over it.
But is anything Alan does not a disaster?
No, but that's the thing. This is one of the rare times he's admitting it.
Yeah.
And then, as we know, Jed Maxwell steps in to help Alan, and he thinks all will be well at Jed's bungalow. Spoiler alert, it's not.
It's really not.
The first issue that Alan has with Jed's bungalow is his choice of art, which obviously he kind of references, or he references in I'm Alan Partridge. He references the topless biker woman with nipples standing at attention like a couple of boob soldiers.
Well,
but weren't her nipples covered in I'm Alan Partridge with stars?
They were.
So that's an inconsistency.
Absolutely gaping hole in
the
story.
We are picking apart the issues with this book here.
And
it revolves around nipples.
And I may have mentioned it at the time, but I suspect
that there was perhaps it was a watershed issue of some kind where weren't allowed that level of graphic nudity because the stars over her nipples didn't look like they were part of the painting. It looked a bit of an afterthought from the makers of the program.
But then this is after, so they could have referenced the fact that there were stars on there. So
that's very true. Well, they could have explained it away, like they did the change in his voice.
Exactly. But, I think they've missed one here, maybe. And then, as we know, Alan steps into Jed's shrine. To Alan and a little bit of David Copperfield.
Losing the battle
for wall space. Alan describes it as one of the weirdest rooms he's ever been in, and that includes Bill Oddie's blast-proof underground bird chamber.
I would like to say at this juncture, if anybody wants to start an industrial noise band with me called Bill Oddie's blast-proof underground bird chamber, I am up for that.
Yes, coming to an ATP near you. So, question to the group. I don't know if anyone's got an answer to this. What's the weirdest room you've ever been in?
The room we're recording this podcast in right now?
I think that's the answer, isn't it?
That's the answer.
If only you could see the things that we can see.
If you're talking surrealism, I was once in Chris from Coldplay's Mum's Kitchen. Does that count?
That's pretty good. Weird is a subjective term, isn't it? So that, for you, that was probably quite a weird experience.
It was quite weird.
And one detail that we don't get in I'm Alan Partridge is that in the book, Alan kind of zooms in and notices the quote-unquote quality of the photos and actually compliments on how good they are. Some are taken from behind bins, some are taken from behind bushes, and most probably unsettlingly, photos with where Jed has obviously been hidden inside Alan's shed.
Is that Jed Maxwell or producer Jed?
They're interchangeable. Maybe they're the same person. We've never seen them in the same room together. And then Jed obviously dons the famous mask, which the book says are available from maskplanet.com/partridgeface, $9.99 for 10. I looked that up. That is not a real website, unfortunately.
Yeah. Okay. So what website did you get when you went on that link?
I don't know. I've got the link here. I'll click it right now.
So Jake Thompson got in touch on our Facebook page when we announced we were going to be covering iPartridge, and he said, you need to look into the link to the badge and blazer set, he means mask, which takes you to myhousematesdiary.com. I've never found out what's going on with this, and he's right, it does take you to that. So I can only assume that somebody, whoever set up myhousematesdiary.com, has basically read iPartridge, checked the internet, realize that no one's got Mask Planet registered and got their own blog on there. So it's probably worth explaining a bit about this blog because I am quite keen to read it. So the synopsis on the blog page says, a while ago now, I found my housemate's personal diaries. Like any good friend, I promptly began transcribing what was written and publishing it on here for all to see. Who wouldn't, right? So if you like nosing into other people's business, reading other people's private thoughts, hearing rather detailed descriptions of a stranger's attempt at having a sex life, then you've come to the right place. Be warned, though, it's quite fruity in places and extremely explicit in others. It basically says on the blog that they're going to keep uploading these diaries on a kind of month-by-month basis, unless if either they get caught or they die. And it hasn't been updated for about 4 years now, I think. So
question to the group.
R.I.P.
Have they been caught or are they dead? I think third option, lost interest.
Yeah, I think it's that, isn't
it? Yeah, I mean, I read a couple of entries. Like, it's quite a funny read, but I don't believe it's real, personally. Mm.
One more thing about the masks in the book. Alan says that they are not to be used for Halloween. Quoting Alan, have a bit of respect. and then Alan describes how the rest of his stay at Jed's plays out. There's a fight, which we kind of get a little bit of a teaser of in I'm Alan Partridge, so he describes that correctly. There's a headlock. We see that. We know that. But then Alan describes the fight sort of developing, and that includes
in
Alan...
kind of a Hollywood action film style detail.
Yeah, so it includes Alan headbutting Jed in the back, punching him in the face, and Jed throwing a chair at Alan.
Yeah. Also, the satisfying thud of bone on gland as he hits him in the nuts, and he says, I've just turned his testicles into a couple of bollock pancakes.
Oh, that's horrible.
Would not order at a restaurant.
I particularly enjoyed Pow. I floor him with a classic one-inch punch. Textbook stuff, a real gut buster.
And obviously we know what happens at the end of this scene, but Alan says that Jed chases him out of the house with a weapon rather than amicably talking about going for a pint with Jed's brother. And then Alan says that he hollers something witty as he drives away. We know that phrase is, no way, you big spastic, you're a mentalist. So not very witty. And obviously the TV ep ends with Alan running across a field. In the book, he runs for 4 miles, finds a public phone box, calls his assistant, and he asks her to pick up the car and deal with Maxwell personally.
Amazing.
Do we think any of those things happened? Did he run for 4 miles? No.
No.
Did he call his assistant?
Yes.
Probably.
Yes,
probably.
Did she go and pick up his car?
Yes.
Did she deal with Maxwell personally?
No.
No.
Possibly.
I think he did stagger to the public phone box because his description of the phone box is brilliant. It says, hanging up, I slump against the side of the phone box and slide into a heap on the floor, the calling cards of 100 local whores raining down on me like big drops of prostitute rain. I begin to weep. I have cheated death. I am free.
That is all the notes. That is very good. That's all the notes I have on this chapter. Anybody else got anything?
I highlighted a footnote from this chapter that I quite enjoyed. So I think this is around with the telephoto lens photography. Alan says, the idea of a man looking at my rock-hard buttocks and salivating makes me want to run home and deadlock the doors. And please don't infer from that that I'm a homophobe. I'm not, and I haven't been since I attended the boat show with Dale Winton, Paul O'Grady, and Noel Edmonds. He's not gay, but you get the picture.
That's great.
But that's actually an interesting admission of essentially him being a homophobe before that.
Yeah. It took a big gay boat show to turn in.
With Noel Edmonds.
But to be fair, when you say that, Alan does make a point in the book about homophobia being a word that before 1980 didn't exist. And if you'd used the term, people would have thought you were referring to a science fiction disease.
And now, chapter 21, Hayes Dead. Nikki J. A., what are the music choices for this chapter?
So the artist is Wings, and the song is Mama Unia.
Okay, thanks.
Sounds good.
I think that's what it is.
Only the band the Beatles could have been.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
That much we do know.
So at the beginning of this chapter, there's quite a nice little gag at the beginning that's in the book, but not actually in the audiobook, I noticed. Alan says that it's been 5 months since the Jed incident and that he's over it now. And he describes Jed as a positive person, an area later half full kind of guy, which I thought was a nice little touch. A nice little callback to obviously the area later.
Why would that not be in the audiobook?
Well, I think we haven't really discussed this. There are some.
Yeah.
There are some quite big differences between the audiobook and the book, right? So.
But some of them make sense, like all the footnotes, that kind of makes sense. But why?
Yeah.
There's actually something that I feel like that occasionally in sections, there's words added or taken away. So there was a section earlier where...
Oh, so it's not verbatim?
No, it's not verbatim at all. There's a section earlier where Alan says in the Glenponder chapter where he's proud to know... He says that he's proud to know Glenponder and describe... I forget how he describes him exactly, but as like a conductor or whatever. In the audiobook, he says the word, I'm proud to know a homosexual who is blah, 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 blah. But in the book, the word homosexual isn't in there.
Oh, right.
Some tinkering's been done, obviously.
Exactly, yeah. So I guess, because one of the things about doing this book would have been written before the audiobook was done. They would go into a studio and they would record it. So there could be times where maybe Coogan thought, oh, I'll just make a little edit. I'll leave a word in. Yeah. I'll take a word out. Or he'll read something and go, actually, I'm not sure that works. Or I'm not such a big fan of it. Let's just cut it out. So I think that's where the differences lie. I think it's just a choice when reading the audiobook about how to do
that.
Yeah.
Or a cynical ploy to get you to buy both.
Oh, Adam.
Well, we've fallen for it.
Yeah. He also referenced right at the start of the chapter, Sue Cook again, saying Sue Cook's voice was shaking. Ordinarily, it would be hard to tell whether it was through emotion or because the pubs had yet to open. But this was 3 p.m, so I knew it was the former.
He's casting her very much in a Dave Clifton sort of light there, isn't he?
He veers wildly between absolute devotion to and really fancying her and painting her as a sort of husky alcoholic.
So obviously, Alan gets the call from Sue about the tragic death of Tony Hayes. It says in the book that Sue tries to contact Alan for an hour, and then when he finds the news, he bows his head for a minute, thinking of his loved ones, and cries a single tear. We know that's bullshit. Because in I'm Alan Partridge, he literally, doesn't he go, yes? Or is that Lynn?
That's
I can't
Lynn
remember.
That goes,
that's Lynn.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But either way, he's delighted and does not shed a single tear for his for Tony Hayes' family.
Well, he goes on to describe it as a good thing to happen, doesn't he? He says, the world, the medium of TV, and more specifically, my mental well-being were all improved by the death of Tony Hayes, 41.
Yep. And then we get a little bit more context about how Alan knows Chris Feather. He describes how their paths crossed in local radio where Chris had been a producer. Alan was impressed with his way with people and his knowledge of ELO.
There's also a section that's in the book, I'm not sure if it's in the audiobook as well, that basically takes up two-thirds of of a page as a footnote just about the time that Alan went to meet a fortune teller, and he basically runs through the claims that she made and how correct they were.
Interestingly, I only listened to the audiobook when making my notes, but read the other chapters to do my notes for other people's sections. So I can tell you that is not in the audiobook.
Okay, so just to give an example, one of the things the gypsy claimed was that he was concerned about travel. Correct. He just put in an expenses claim for a non-work-related train journey back to my car after an over-ambitious ramble and was panicking that he'd be exposed. One more, he said, so she says, someone close to me with the letter E in their name had health concerns. Correct. My daughter Denise, he's capitalised both the E's, had been suffering from migraines and was sent to see a specialist, although it just turned out to be a stress-related illness from overwork.
Yeah, so I think a lot of the stuff they've taken out is the footnotes, because I guess they probably disrupt the flow.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
But yeah, when you're reading the book, it's a nice kind of almost extra visual gag when you see how massive some of the footnotes are, because they're nearly a page.
And then Alan heads to the funeral. Again, another thing that we know what happens in I'm Alan Partridge, which differs in the book. Alan says that he cries with Jane Hayes, who he says is happy with the travel clock, but still unhappy at being widowed.
The only tears he shed is his frustration trying to find a battery for an Ericsson. Yeah. Yeah.
So we know that this is all nonsense and not actually true.
He also feels the need to clarify that there was no kind of affection, or that the hug that he has with Jane wasn't in any way sensual, which is kind of a given, but no, he feels the need to clarify.
Absolutely,
that,
of course.
And then also qualify it by saying that he can't speak on her behalf because potentially there might have been some sensuality on her side.
He also says for the vis-a-vis his gift, she was happy with the travel clock, but she was still upset at being widowed, as if the fact that his Littlewood's catalogue travel clock might have eclipsed the grief.
Everything's
death.
Okay now, Alan.
Littlewood's
are
good.
Now can I have a sensual hug?
It's time to move on.
Yes, it is. So Alan then describes the signing of the £200,000 a year contract.
This
with
is
Chris.
Great.
This is very, very good.
Yeah, I love the description with the meeting with Chris Feather. And it's, in a way, it's kind of the opposite to the death of Forbes McAllister. So Alan is at pains to describe how well Chris is. So Chris was in good spirits, alert and of sound mind, and just kind of putting these excuses in, like, I trapped my hand in a door earlier, so my hand hurts and my signature might end up looking a bit weird, but I should still be able to sign this.
But that's just an out-and-out lie. I mean, that's not happened. He didn't say that. Alan's just lying.
Yeah, but then we saw the whole encounter.
That's the joke.
So Alan has officially signed his contract with the BBC, or so he thinks. That's the end of that chapter. I haven't got any more notes. Has anyone got anything else to add on Hayes Dead?
Alan says that the contract would time to BBC TV on a £200,000 a year deal. Do we think that is good value for money, particularly based on the recent BBC charter that revealed income?
I guess this was the 90s.
Yeah. I mean, is it 5 years at £200,000 a year? Did he say five?
It's £200,000 a year for 5 years.
Yeah, so that's £1 million. Yes. So that would put him slightly below Gary Lineker in terms of the
that's
recent...
annual though for Lineker.
Yeah, that's annual.
He's basically a female newsreader.
So he's
okay.
Well, yeah. Well, then what the BBC published recently was anything above £150,000. Mm-hmm. So he would be in the top earnings bracket. He's not as much as Chris Evans, for example.
Yeah.
But he's on par with whoever that guy that pretends the one show is.
I'll tell you what, we'll have a look down the BBC pay list and we'll try and find Alan's pay equivalent and come back to you next week with that.
One last thing I would like to add that I've just noticed in the book. Obviously, Alan signs is told how much the contract is in the show, and he's kind of like, it's £1 million. Like, he's genuinely blown away and surprised. Yeah. But in here, he says, I wouldn't say I was particularly ecstatic. It was no less than I deserved.
Yeah. They also quite nicely repeat the negative, and I need two positives point here. It was no less than I deserve, which meant it was one positive that cancelled out the negative of Hayes snubbing me, but not a second positive that would push my happiness level higher than average.
His happiness system remains strong and consistent.
Very consistent, yeah.
Indeed.
So that takes us to the end of this section of the book and the end of this episode. Join us next week when we're going to be cracking on with chapter 22, which is supposedly called Homelessnessness, but I've just noticed in the book it's Homelessnessness. Possibly a typo there. We'll investigate and get back. We'll investigate and get back to you next week. If you'd like to get in touch with us in the meantime, it's thepartridgepod@gmail.com. It's at thepartridgepod on Twitter. It's facebook.com/thepartridgepod. It's Instagram @monkeytennispod. Don't forget to grab tickets for the live show, postpoppodcast.com/monkeytennis. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll join you next week for some more iPartridge. From everybody at Monkey Tennis, goodbye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Monkey Tennis. Smelly Alan Partridge.
Linton Travel Tavern seemed an obvious choice.
Monkey tennis?
At the BBC of all places. Be real.
Monkey tennis?
Where's my assistant? I do not know.
Monkey tennis?
I wish things had turned out differently, but I'm glad they didn't.
Monkey tennis?
It will be called Alan's Show. I decided, and would be absolutely ace.
Monkey tennis?
But needless to say, I had the last laugh.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.